Thank you very much. Well, good evening. It's a real pleasure to be here. And what I'd like to do in the next hour or so is to give you a sense of the excitement that is brewing as we begin to understand more and more deeply and in a fine-grained manner how cancers develop. And the way that we're doing that is through understanding the secrets that are hidden within the genomes of cancer cells. So cancer is a fact of life. One in three people develop the disease. One in five in the developed world will die of cancer. And this word cancer, which we use to generically describe a large number of different diseases, there are about 100 to 200 different types of cancer, as currently classified anyway, each of these developing from a different organ, the breast, the lung, the liver, and then within different cells within that organ. So our current classification of cancer is built upon what we believe is the cell from which a particular cancer type originates. Now, although there's this great diversity in this large number of different diseases, each of which has its different causation and different prevalence and incidence and different characteristics, there are some common features underlying all cancers. They all share a biological similarity. So this is a piece of colon that has been removed from a patient, and this excrescence here is a colorectal cancer. And we can understand a little bit more about what cancers are by looking at both the normal and the tumor under the microscope. So if we first of all look in the normal colon, what we will see is illustrated here. Each of these is a single cell lining the wall of the colon, and each of these cells has this clear area, which is a sort of mucus-like substance, which the cell secretes into this cavity, which makes its way out into the center of the colon, and that lubricates the colon such that the feces can pass through. So what you should be getting from this picture is that each of these cells looks very similar. It's reasonably well ordered. At the bottom, you can just about see this blue bit, which is the nucleus of each cell. And there is a single row of nuclei that are at the bottom of all those cells. So this is order. This is well regulated. This is function. If we now decide to look to push our microscope over the cancer, we see something that is familiar, but nevertheless distinctly different. So we still see a lining of cells, and there's a cavity here, but we don't see those blobs. Because although the cancer has derived from that normal colon that I showed you before, in becoming a cancer, it has lost some of that normal functionality. And if we go up really close, what we see is that instead of having those nuclei nicely ordered along the bottom, they are piling up, one on top of each other, and they're very large, they're jagged, they are irregular, and they're different from each other. What this bespeaks is deregulation, abnormal, unregulated growth. And that is, of course, the feature of all cancers. And if we now look just at the periphery of this cancer, what we see is these tongues, these islands of cells, which are originating from the cancer but are now diving deep through the wall of the colon because they're invading. Of course, invasion is a key feature of cancers, and ultimately these groups of cells will find their way to a blood vessel and they will disseminate throughout the body to cause metastasis. And that's what is usually the cause of death of patients with cancer. So we have one level of view of the cancer, which is this abnormal biological behavior, this deregulated growth. So how do these cancers originate? And I'll show you here in figurative form. This is supposed to represent a set of cells, similar to what I was showing you in the normal colon. Here is a cavity into which they might be making their secretions, and here is the tissue underneath. So this is obviously a very well-ordered lining. But what occasionally happens is that a single cell within that lining acquires slightly different growth properties. It begins to grow a little bit more than its neighbours, it occupies a little bit more space than its neighbours, it begins to pile up more than its neighbours. So this is derived from a single cell, it's a clone, and it's behaving a little bit abnormally. Of course, this isn't going to do anybody any harm. Most of us in this room have hundreds or thousands of these abnormal clones within us. As we get older, we become bags of early cancers. And in fact, if we look at our skin, we see multiple moles. And of course, moles are good examples of this sort of event. And most moles don't do us any harm at all. So this isn't really a problem. But what then happens is that a single cell within this proliferation now begins to behave even more abnormally than its colleagues. And it now begins to grow out as a subclone of the original clone. And you can see here that it's piling up more than that original clone. It's a bit more disordered. But it's still retained within the cavity. And then one cell within that clone, a subclone of the original clone, now begins to behave even more abnormally. And it begins to grow in a very deregulated way, such that it can now invade and metastasize. So all cancers arise through these waves of clonal expansions. And so all cancers are originally derived from a single cell, and so they're all clones of cells. So the question we have to ask ourselves is, why should a single cell start to behave in this abnormal way? And the reason it applies to all cancers is because there have been changes within the genome, within the DNA of that single cell, and those changes in the DNA have driven the cell to behave in the abnormal way that I've been showing you. So we can revise a little bit. We can review what we mean by a genome. This is, again, a little bit of that picture of the normal colon. And at the bottom of this cell, there is this blue area, which is the nucleus. And the nucleus contains the genetic material, the DNA. And if we could focus in on that DNA, we would see that it's packaged in this way as chromosomes, 22 chromosomes, then an X and a Y if one's a male, and two X's if one's a female. And we now know, of course, that what these chromosomes represent are strings of letters of code. DNA can be read from one end to the other. Each chromosome can be read from one end to the other as a long string of letters. In the whole human genome, there are 3,000 letters of DNA, 3,000 million letters of DNA code. And we know that in this alphabet of DNA, there are four letters in that alphabet, A, T, C, and G, and it is the combinations of A, T, C, and G, as you read, which generates the individuality of DNA codes. So our genome is made up of 3,000 million letters, like this, and within that genome, there are these units, the genes. 21,000 genes, each occupying a portion of the genome, and each one representing the code for a protein. And a protein is part of the moving machinery of the cell. So the cogs, the springs, the widgets, the pulleys, each of those is a protein, and each one of those 21,000 proteins is coded for by an individual gene. So the number of these moving parts, 21,000, is essentially equivalent to the number of a modern jet aircraft. So we're built up in a similar way to a jet. So each cell in the body contains a copy of the genome. And it's a pretty good copy, but it's not perfect. And the reason it's not perfect is because as we go through life, every cell in our body, the DNA within it, is acquiring mutations. And these mutations that we're all acquiring in every cell are called somatic mutations. These are not mutations that are inherited from our parents. These are not mutations that we will transmit to our children. These are mutations that are occurring in cells of our body. And they occur in all the cells of the body, all normal cells throughout life. So here is that string of letters of DNA code that I showed you. And what are the factors that cause these somatic mutations? Well, one is, of course, cells have to divide. They have to replenish themselves. And when a cell divides, it has to replicate its DNA. So it has to replicate all 3,000 million letters of code. So that's quite challenging, and the cells do a pretty good job of it. However, it's not perfect. And as cells divide, a couple, probably no more than a couple in most normal cells, of those 3,000 million letters are replicated erroneously. So just the process of being a multicellular organism that has to keep itself going introduces somatic mutations into cells of the body. Of course, we can help that process along. There are certain cells of the body that get exposed to radiation, as you can see here. And so the cells of the skin are constantly being bathed in ultraviolet light from the sun. And if one exposes oneself in southern climes to large amounts of ultraviolet radiation, that radiation will hit DNA and it will cause mutations, somatic mutations, in the skin. And of course, if we are willful enough to inhale tar-like extracts containing more than 60 organic chemicals, which are deeply mutagenic to DNA through cigarette smoking, then those chemicals will damage DNA, will bind to DNA, and they will cause mutations in those tissues that are exposed, the lung. And there are other chemicals that can cause mutations, cause damage to DNA. This is a particular chemical, it's called aflatoxin, and it is produced by a fungus in Africa which infects peanuts. And this chemical, when it is ingested, causes hepatocellular carcinoma in parts of Africa. But in fact, there are many, many chemicals, some of them exogenous, but actually many of them generated within our own body, that damage DNA. The chemical actually binds to DNA and will damage it. In fact, it's remarkable that in every cell of the body, in the course of a day, it is believed there are something like 20 to 50,000 letters of code that have to be repaired because they've been damaged mainly by internal chemicals. So our DNA in all our cells is constantly under assault from all these factors which are damaging it. So with that amount of artillery being directed at our DNA, we've got to sort of bat it off somehow. We have to repair it. And there are large numbers of DNA repair mechanisms which are designed to get rid of most of this damage. However, you can imagine that in a particular cell, if a DNA repair mechanism stops functioning for one reason or another, perhaps the gene that makes the relevant protein that repairs the DNA, that gene acquires a mutation, then that cell will start to accumulate lots and lots of DNA damage, and DNA damage gets converted into mutations, changes in DNA sequence. So these are all the factors that are continually generating somatic mutations in all the cells of our body. So what are these mutations? Well, DNA is a relatively simple molecule, at least when represented in this way. And the mutations can be simple changes of a letter of code. So this G is converted to a T, called a substitution. Or these four letters, this C's, G, G, A, can just be deleted so that now the T will be next to the C. Or, coming back to that original DNA sequence, it can break. And when it's broken, it can then join up with another piece of DNA that is also broken, which can be from somewhere else completely in the genome, from another chromosome. And this type of mutation is called a rearrangement because the DNA has essentially been reshuffled. And of course, we start with two copies of every piece of DNA, one inherited from our mother, one inherited from our father. And another type of somatic mutation is that instead of having two copies of a piece of DNA in one cell, it goes up to 20 copies, sometimes to 100, sometimes to several thousand copies of the same piece of DNA. So these are all the different types of mutation that can occur in cells and are occurring in cells in our body throughout life. Now, we've been thinking about the genomes within cells, within cancers, for a good long time. In fact, one of the most profound observations about cancer was made almost 100 years ago by Theodore Bovary, who looked down the microscope of cancer cells at cancers, and what he saw was that the nucleus that contained too many chromosomes. And that was, of course, a very profound observation. He didn't know that the nucleus contained DNA. He didn't know really even about genes. But he did know that the nucleus contained the inherited material, and he could see that the heritable material was abnormal in some cancers. And that was the first insight into the role of the genome, into the genesis of cancer. And since that time, studying the genome in cancers has been a central focus of cancer research. And we've been able to do that in many different ways. The excitement that is being generated at the moment is because our tools for looking at the cancer genome have really improved dramatically over the last 5 to 10 years. Our ability essentially to sequence DNA has been advancing in a remarkable fashion. And I illustrate it here. This is how we used to sequence DNA radioactively in about 1980. In the 90s, we sequenced DNA using fluorescent dyes on capillary, so-called capillary sequences. And this was the way in which the human genome was sequenced, the reference human genome. Now, we're using a new suite of technologies in which millions, hundreds of millions of pieces of DNA are being sequenced simultaneously with each other on glass slides, so-called massively parallel sequencing. And look at the changes in sequencing power that that has brought. So if we look at about 2002, so less than a decade ago, a single sequencing machine, one that did this sort of thing, produced sequence in this fashion, could generate 1 million letters of DNA code per day. And we thought that was pretty amazing at that time. One machine, 1 million letters per day. Now look at what the machines are doing for us. Now we are generating 100,000 million letters of code per day. So that's a transformation equivalent to me going outside and looking at the moon and me actually being on the moon fiddling around with bits of rock. It's exquisite resolution that we can now get into the genomes of, into all types of genomes, but particularly those of cancer cells, to see all the changes that are occurring. And it's these changes in technology that are driving the new insights. So what characteristics are there that the old technologies and these new technologies are bringing to us with respect to the cancer genome? What's going on in the nucleus of this cancer cell? Well, the first thing that we've known for quite a while is that cancer genomes often have quite a lot of changes in them compared to the normal genome and can be very disorganized. So here we depict the genome in a particular way. This is from a normal cell where the each chromosome is shown in its pair. So these are two chromosome ones, and each chromosome is colored a particular color. So chromosome one is in yellow, chromosome two is in red, chromosome three in light blue. So that's what the normal human genome looks like, and this is what a cancer genome can look like. First of all, you can see that instead of having two normal chromosome ones, you've got something like six here, and you've got multiple copies of many of the other chromosomes too. But what you can also see, if we let's say look at this one here, is that part of it is chromosome 4, part of it is a red chromosome, perhaps chromosome 2, part of it is yellow, probably derived from chromosome 1. So this is a chromosome which is made up from three different chromosomes. So this is the genome rearranging itself, reshuffling itself. And you can see that it's pretty abnormal, pretty disorganized. But frankly, you haven't seen anything yet, because this only gives you a bit of a flavor of a hint of the disorganization of cancer genomes. The second thing is that although the genome is core to the genesis of all cancers, there is really great variability between individual cancers in just how disorganized the genome is. And I'll illustrate that with two breast cancers in which we looked for, using the new sequencing technology, we looked for rearrangements. So we looked for those bits of DNA that have reshuffled themselves. And here what we do is we depict the genome in a circular fashion. So this is chromosome 1, 2, 3. They're numbered, but you can't see the numbers. All the way around to chromosome 22, X and Y. And this, from a breast cancer from a 53-year-old, you can see there is a purple line between the bit of the genome here on chromosome 3 and chromosome 11. So in this breast cancer, there's a single abnormal connection, a rearrangement, a reshuffling between chromosome 3 and chromosome 11. That's in a breast cancer, and this is another breast cancer. And what you can see is that this genome has essentially been shredded and put back together again. You can see loads and loads of purple lines connecting all those different chromosomes. And what you can also see is these green lines. And those green lines are rearrangements that have taken place within a chromosome. So one part of chromosome 1 has joined to another part of chromosome 1 that it would not usually be joined to. And there are huge numbers of these within this genome as well. And in fact, until we got these new sequencing technologies, we were essentially unaware of all these green lines. And we only got those technologies 2-3 years ago. So the insights have been really coming in leaps and bounds over the last couple of years. But what this is supposed to demonstrate is that there is considerable diversity in the degree of disruption of the cancer genome. So here I'm showing it to you in terms of these rearrangements. I could show you a different set of plots for those single base changes, the C to a T. Some cancers have very few. Some cancers have huge numbers of them. So within this group of diseases that we call cancer, there is massive diversity and difference in the state of the genome. and you can see differences between individual classes of cancers. And when you take one class, you can see, as you're seeing here, differences even within that class of cancer. So we understand that those abnormally enlarging clones are driven by the abnormalities in their genome. But that still doesn't take us to understand why the cell should be responding to these abnormalities in its genome. But basically, we believe that these mutations, these somatic mutations, can be divided into two groups. There are those mutations within an individual cancer which are the drivers. Those are the ones which are causing the cancer to behave in the abnormal way that we now are familiar with. And those driver mutations are present within, by definition, cancer genes. So those mutations have fallen within a particular gene, which, when it's caused to be mutated and become abnormal, it then drives the cell to behave like a cancer. But most of the mutations in cancer cells are passengers. They're not actually contributing to the genesis, to the drive, to the biology of the cancer. They've just been taken along for the ride. And of course, as I've been saying to you, all cells within our body are acquiring these somatic mutations. So in most cells, these somatic mutations don't do any harm at all. The cell lives with them. The occasional cell may die, but that's not a big deal. Most cells survive with these mutations as we get older, accruing more and more of them. But it's that occasional cell which gets the right set of mutations in the right genes, that's the cell that then goes on to become a cancer. So we've seen how these clones arise, and what we now believe is that this cell, which was the first one to start expanding a little bit, the reason it did it was because it had many passenger mutations, perhaps, but one of the mutations had fallen in a cancer gene. Then one of these, this first purple cell, it had acquired another mutation in a cancer gene. So now that cell had two mutated cancer genes. And then finally, one of these purple cells started to behave abnormally like this, and it had acquired a third cancer gene mutation. So three different cancer genes mutated in order to generate that fully fledged cancer. That's a really key metric of cancers. How many mutated cancer genes are there in an individual cancer? You'd have thought after all these years of cancer research, we would know the answer. We don't. We have many speculations, many of them rather controversial and engendering a certain amount of heated debate. But we're going to know the answer to this question in the next few years, because we're going to be able to sequence cancer genomes and simply count the number of driver mutations, mutated cancer genes in each genome. So this sort of work, looking for these mutated cancer genes, has been central to cancer research, as I've said, for a century, but of course allowed to happen for the last 30 years since the advent of recombinant DNA technology. And a search for these cancer genes, these genes which, when they're mutated in the right way, can make a cell behave like a cancer, has been pretty fruitful. We now know of about more than 400 genes in the human genome which, if they're mutated in the right way, will be able to cause one or other of those 200 different types of cancer. So that's a number that we can reflect on for a moment, because there are 21,000 genes in the human genome, protein-coding genes, and 400 of them, we already know, can be implicated in cancer genesis. So that means 2% of the genes in the human genome, if you mutate them in the right way, will contribute to the genesis of cancer. So we hold the seeds of our own destruction within ourselves. We're at 2% now. We don't know what that final number of cancer genes is going to, where it's going to take us. Could it be that as many as 10% of the genes in the human genome, if you mutate them in the right way, will contribute to one or other types of cancer? We don't know at the moment. We will be finding out. Now, those cancer genes, those 400 cancer genes, come in two flavors. The mutation in that cancer gene can either switch it off, switch the gene off, and switch its protein off, and that's what causes the cell to become a cancer, or, conversely, the mutation can switch the gene and its protein on. So having too much of the gene, too much of the protein, causes cancer. So we can classify them as switched off cancer genes and switched on cancer genes, and you can see that in this count of more than 400, the majority at the moment are switched on. Whether that's the way it plays out once the current wave of research comes to fruition, we'll have to see, but that's the current state of it. So now with these new technologies, we're able to look at individual cancer genomes and start to look at these cancer genes and begin to see how individual cancers are built. And I'll show you some of the results from our own studies, in this case from a kidney cancer, to give you some of the insights into the main messages that are emerging. So this is a form of kidney cancer called clear cell renal cancer. That's the normal kidney there. That's the tumor there, that yellow lump. And if we look at that under the microscope, what you see is a lot of cells. These blue dots are the nuclei, and the cells have rather clear cytoplasm, hence the name of the tumor. And what's interesting about this cancer, and why we chose to study it at the time that we embarked on this piece of work, was that they all look pretty much the same. You can look down the microscope at 100 of these, and you don't see much difference. Rather, stereotypical, monotonous type of cancer, all looking like that. So, what we can now do is to start sequencing the genomes of these cancers. So in this case, we've looked at about 100 of these renal cancers. We didn't do the whole genome. We looked at the genes, the 21,000 protein-coding genes, essentially. And each of these bars represents one cancer from one patient. So there are 101 cancers shown here. And so we sequenced the protein-coding genes, and we got the mutations, and we looked through the mutations, and through on the basis of our knowledge and various other analytical approaches, we were able to say, right, in this cancer we can find driver mutations in this cancer gene, and that one. In another cancer, we can find mutations in different cancer genes. So let's look at what the patterns are. This is the list of cancer genes which we found mutations in, which we discovered actually in the course of this study, and which we found mutations in. So the first thing to say about this list is that if you go to a different type of cancer, you will see a completely different list of genes. So we've already been talking about the diversity of cancer. I've shown you previously the state of the genomes can be very different. But now if we compare different cancer types, the genes which are operating to drive those cancers are very different. So they really are different animals. In some senses, this is sort of disappointing, because if you're really wanting to focus on treating these, it would be better if there was one gene that was operative in all cancers. In fact, if all cancers were due to the same set of genes. It's not that way. So we have a list of genes here which is implicated in this cancer. And what each of these red bars shows is that, for example, for this first cancer, there's a mutation in this gene and in this gene and in no others. In this cancer, there's a mutation in this gene. So that's the pattern. Now, we can pick out two of those 101 cancers and see what it tells us. So here we have just two of those 101. This one with a mutation in this gene, and this gene, and this individual cancer in that gene, and that gene. What you can see quite clearly is that they do not share any genes between them. These are two clear cell renal cancers, which I've already told you look absolutely, essentially identical down the microscope. We would always group them together. We'd certainly treat them as the same entity. And yet, when you look at the genes which are driving them, they're completely different. So is it so surprising as we find these different patterns, even with one monotonous type of cancer, that cancers are so unpredictable in their response to treatment? Because you could quite easily say, well, actually, although they look similar on the microscope, these are two different diseases because the genes that are driving them are just different. In fact, it may not be as different as all that. We have yet to learn much about that, but it could be that this gene and this gene, although they're different genes, they subserve more or less the same biological function. Perhaps they're even on the same pathway, in which case they're doing exactly the same thing because they're on the same biochemical pathway, so the same outcome. We don't know yet enough about the ways in which these different genes network to know how true or not that is. Frankly, for the future of cancer therapeutics, we have to hope that many of these genes are on more or less the same pathways, and there is some evidence in favor of that. Otherwise, it's really going to be very difficult for us to target our therapeutic strategies. Nevertheless, whatever, we have to be aware of the fact that even within one stereotypical, monotonous type of cancer, there is this hidden diversity underlying it. And indeed, if we now go back to the 101 cancers, if you were to say that each different combination of these mutated cancer genes was one subtype, then there are something of the order of 15 different subtypes of this cancer, which previously we thought of as one type. So we're beginning to see that there is great diversity. We're beginning to be able to count the number of mutated cancer genes. So in this particular case, there are three. We don't understand why some only have one. And what is going on here, we are rather at sea about. I've given you the dogma. The dogma is that there have to be mutated cancer genes, at least one, and we're failing to find them. You know, the technology isn't so great at the moment. We could be missing them. Alternatively, we could be beginning to uncover a deeper mystery about the genesis of some cancers. And in this particular case of clear cell renal cancer, we previously classified those cancer genes as switched off or switched on. All the genes involved seem to be genes that are switched off. You can go to another class of cancer and find that it's half and half, genes that are switched on and switched off, and to another class of cancer, it's always genes that are switched on. We have no idea why there should be these differences between cancer types at the moment, but this is what's emerging from all this cancer genome sequencing. So that is one of the main fruits, and that is one set of insights that is coming out of the sequencing of these genomes, the understanding of these driving mutations, these key cancer genes, which are responsible for the disease. However, there is a core area of cancer research which is still rather dark to us, which is, what is causing these mutations in the first place? Cancer is essentially a disease of DNA. All cancers are caused by these somatic mutations. But we have a pretty rudimentary idea at this moment as to what causes these somatic mutations. And what I'll show you now is a little bit about how we can use cancer genomes and the mutations that we are finding in cancer genomes to start to derive insights into what is responsible for generating these mutations in the first place. And I'll illustrate the point with this cancer, malignant melanoma, a tumor of skin, of which this is one example. It develops from melanocytes in skin, and the risk factors, notably for this discussion, include exposure to sunlight. Common disease in Australia, where fair-skinned people for many years were exposing themselves to an awful lot of UV. So we know that that is a cause of malignant melanoma. And a year or two ago, we took a single case of malignant melanoma, which had been made into a long-standing cancer cell line, which is called this, which is now immortal in the petri dish, in the test tube, but which originally came from a man aged 43, and indeed from the line was made from a metastasis of his melanoma to the umbilicus. So it was a malignant melanoma, and this malignant melanoma, we did a whole cancer genome sequence. And this was, in fact, the first cancer which was completely sequenced, by which I mean that we extracted from this genome of this malignant melanoma essentially all the somatic mutations that were present. We depict them in this way, which I won't go into, but familiar to you perhaps will be already these. These are the rearrangements in the genome, and then all the other types of mutations are shown elsewhere in this circle with the genome itself and the chromosomes around the outside. But the key here is that we found for the first time all the mutations that are present. And in this particular malignant melanoma, there are more than 33,000 of those single base changes, single letter of code changes, a G to a T, an A to a C. There are 33,000 of those and smaller numbers of the little deletions and then the rearrangements. So what can we learn from that catalogue of mutations in this individual cancer? Well, a lot of work that's been done over the years has been looking at how ultraviolet light might cause damage and mutations to DNA. And we know that UV does damage DNA, and the way that it does it is to make an abnormal connection between two adjacent letters of code. And those two are usually a T and a C, or a C and a C, and that's the abnormal connection, an abnormal chemical bond, and that distorts the double helix. So when it distorts the double helix, the DNA and the DNA has to be replicated. The machinery to replicate the DNA comes along here, and it can't get past that distortion of the double helix. It doesn't like it. So in order to get past it, it recruits in additional machinery, but that additional machinery is sloppy. It's sloppy, it gets past here, and so can continue replicating, but it doesn't replicate this bit faithfully. In other words, it introduces errors, it introduces mutations. And this is the sort of mutation that occurs. This C becomes a T, and the C becomes a T after a T or a C. It's either of those. So we have a distinctive type of mutation, that C to T, and it's a distinctive sequence context in which it occurs. So we can now look in this genome of this man aged 43, and we can look at the mutations and ask the question, do they bear any resemblance to the mutations that are caused by ultraviolet light? And so we can classify those 33,000 single letter of code changes into their six different classes, T to G, T to C, T to A, C to T, C to G, and C to A, And you can see that by far the large majority of those mutations are C to T, exactly as you would expect, as if ultraviolet light had been causing those mutations. So that's compatible with the vast majority of mutations in this malignant melanoma being due to ultraviolet light. It's compatible, but it's not fantastic evidence because there are quite a lot of other processes, DNA damage processes, that cause C to T mutations. But don't forget, we have the context, the sequence context in which they occur. So what I'm showing here is an exercise whereby we went to the reference human genome, we pulled out all the C's, and then we asked, what are the letters of code around all those C's? In particular, what is the letter of code immediately before the C? So here are the C's in blue, and if you look at where the letter of code before the millions of C's in the genome, you can see that T, G, C, and A are more or less equally represented as the letters of code just upstream of those C's. So this is random C's in the genome. Now, let's look at those C's which are mutated to T in that malignant melanoma. So we're just looking at that subset of C's. And now, when we look at the sequence context, clearly it's different. The sequences around these are different from random C's. And if we look carefully, what we see is that before the mutated C, it's either a T or a C. Very, very rarely a G or an A. So you'll perhaps remember that diagram I showed you a few moments ago. This is exactly the sequence context in which ultraviolet light produces mutations. C to T mutations after either a T or a C. So this is giving us increasing evidence that the vast majority of the mutations in this malignant melanoma were in fact caused by ultraviolet light. Now, of course, that's proving what we thought anyway. Nevertheless, we can now go on to examine this and other cancers with the knowledge that the catalogues of mutations in individual cancers are like an archaeological record of what these cells have been exposed to in the past. By analyzing the patterns, we will see traces of the effects of all the mutagenic processes that have been operative in generating this cancer in the first place. And as we start looking, using these genomic techniques, this sequencing, at larger numbers of cancers, we're finding patterns that we just don't understand, we've never seen before. Patterns of mutation which must reflect mutational processes, exposures, defects in DNA repair, which we have no idea of at the moment. So by looking at the genomes of cancers, not only are we going to find the genes that drive the cancers, but we're going to find out what is it about the way that we live that is causing cancers in the first place, that is causing these mutations. Now, these mutated cancer genes do have an important facility for us. We know that the cancers can't be cancers without these mutated cancer genes. So, in a very simple manner, we can think, if we could just reverse the effects of those mutations in the cancer genes, perhaps we could cause the cancers to stop growing. It's a very simple notion. Some often did say in the past, a very simplistic notion. But nevertheless, let's see what we can do with that. These mutated cancer genes are the Achilles heel of each cancer. So 8 years ago, we discovered a new mutated cancer gene in malignant melanoma. That gene is called BRAF. And we found that this mutated cancer gene has mutations in 70% of malignant melanoma, 30% of thyroid cancer, 10% of colorectal cancer, and a few others. Now, the way that BRAF acts is as follows. It is part of a pathway that signals into the cell in response to signals coming in from outside the cell, telling the cell to grow. So these are the signaling molecules coming from outside, and what happens is that one of them binds to this receptor on the cell surface, and that sends a signal through a number of nodes, through some number of transmitting points into the cell, telling the cell to grow. And BRAF is one of those nodes. And you can see that in a normal cell, what happened there was the signal came in, it told, was transmitted into the nucleus, the cell grew, and then it stopped growing, exactly as you'd expect if things are normally regulated. But in a cancer, the problem is that BRAF is mutated. And that mutation causes it to be stuck in the on position. And it continues to signal into the center of the cell, into the nucleus, to grow. There's no signal coming from the outside. The cell is being duped. It's being duped by that mutation in BRAF into believing that it's constantly being told to grow. And that cell is growing slavishly in response to that signal, and that's why it is a cancer. Now, BRAF causes a certain amount of interest and excitement. Malignant melanoma, when it has spread, is a remorseless disease. It really is responsive to nothing. No chemicals, no chemotherapy, no radiation, nothing will touch it. It is essentially a death sentence. Now, the point about BRAF was it had one or two interesting features, the first of which is that the mutations switch it on. It's one of those switched on genes. And that's a good thing with respect to cancer therapeutics, because what most drugs do is switch things off. They interfere. So if you've got a gene that is switched on, you have an opportunity to find a drug that switches it off. And if you can switch it off, perhaps the cancer will stop growing. The second thing about BRAF is that it is part of a family of molecules. They're essentially enzymes. They are built in such a way that they are more druggable than many other proteins. So this set in train a process of attempts to discover drugs that would inhibit mutated BRAF, with the expectation that when one could do that, that although the BRAF would still have its mutation, it would no longer be signaling to the center of the cell to grow. And so perhaps the cell would stop growing. Many groups around the world started looking for these drugs, most of the pharmaceutical companies. And a couple of years ago, one small biotech came up with this drug, known as Plexicon 4032, which was subsequently put into phase 1 and most recently 2 and 3 phase 3 clinical trials. And this is an illustration of the results. This is a scan of a patient with malignant melanoma. All these black splodges are metastatic malignant melanoma. This poor chap is riddled. You can see it's all the way up and down the bone marrow of his femur, up here in his humerus. It's literally all over the place. Extraordinary depiction of what cancer can do. This guy was given this new drug, Plexicon 4032, which is an inhibitor of BRAF. It was known that this malignant melanoma in him had the BRAF mutation. And this is what his scan looked like 15 days afterwards. What it has done, it has essentially switched off the cancer metabolically. If you look carefully, you can see that there's still cancer cells there, but they've kind of, the light has gone out in them. They're not dead, but they have gone sort of quiescent. And over time, as cells turn over, the expectation is that they will die. This is the bladder, this is the kidneys, so it's just being excreted, the dye is just being excreted, so that's not cancer. So this is a remarkable illustration of how finding these mutated cancer genes can lead you to develop therapies which were previously unimaginable. In Australia, about a year ago, sitting in front of a couple of clinical oncologists who were being shown this picture, one whispered to the other, "I never thought I'd see the day." Because that's a fairly extraordinary picture of what the combination of modern genomics, finding the gene in the first place, finding the mutations, coupled with drug discovery in all its various scientific forms and clinical trialing can deliver. The first BRAF mutation was found in about right at the end of 2001, and in 2011 we've gone from finding the gene, characterizing it, developing small molecules, putting them through clinical trials into a phase 3 clinical trial, and showing that there is a significant improvement in survival. That's a pretty amazing feat for the whole compendium of modern biological technologies to deliver. That is the good side, the optimistic side of the story. The bad side of the story is that cancers are devious beasts. This individual, as most individuals who have malignant melanoma with a BRAF mutation who are treated with this drug, somewhere amongst that sea of cancer cells that is disseminated within this person, there is a cell which has acquired an additional mutation which allows it to be resistant to the Plexxikon drug. And over time, that cell isn't subject to the constraints which have turned the other ones off, and it starts growing untouched by the drug, such that several months, a year later, it emerges as a new lump of cancer, malignant melanoma, which is now resistant to the Plexxikon drug. So this is the constant wrangle that we, the cancer research community, have with the cancer. Is this the end of the game? It isn't. The point of this is that it's the foot in the door. We never saw, we thought we'd see this sort of thing. Yes, the cancer is coming back at us, but there are other examples where, despite the emergence of resistant clones, we can design our drugs to get round the resistance mutations. And so there will be this continuing bout between the cancer and the research community to see who can find most ways to outfox the others. I think it is fair to say that the cancer only has a limited repertoire of ways it can become resistant. We have to hang on to that. And if we can find the ways of dealing with all the components of that repertoire, we may come out on top. So the current state of cancer genomics is being driven by this technology, by the increasing sense that is going to generate many insights. And around the world, we have brought together the various groups, various funding bodies, on a mission to really understand the genomes of cancer in a coordinated way. Through the offices of the International Cancer Genome Consortium, a number of groups and funding bodies have put in really quite substantial amounts of resource to generate large numbers of cancer genomes of all these types from around the world. And the anticipation is that over the next 5 to 7 years, we will sequence the genomes of something of the order of 25,000 cancers. And of course, when we do that, we have to sequence the normal genomes from the same people. So there's actually 50,000 genomes. There is no bigger DNA sequencing project in the world. And indeed, there has never been a project quite like it in cancer research, with the coordination and with the resourcing to really give us that deep picture of what is present in the cancer genome. And once we've done those 25,000 cancer genomes, we will then know more or less the full repertoire of cancer genes that are operative across the range of human cancer. We will know the full range of combinations of mutated cancer genes that are operative in individual cancers. And we will have a really fine-grained idea of all the mutational patterns and mutational processes that have been operative. And once we have that, cancer research will be entering a new era. So thank you very much for your attention.